History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned is they don't have to go untold if we'll take a little time to ask some questions, and more importantly, if we'll take the time to listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, and I trust that'll be the case again today in Turlock, California, home for nearly 70 years now to Wayne Bailey, 94 years old, a Navy veteran of World War II. But you did not grow up here in the Central Valley of California, a long way from here. Tell me where your earliest memories were formed, Wayne.
In Spring Valley, Minnesota. Actually, I was born in Chatfield, Minnesota, which is about 15 miles from Spring Valley, but I was born in Chatfield, Minnesota on the farm. We were there until I was 8 years old, and then we moved to Spring Valley, where my father went into the grocery business. We lost the farm.
Yeah, and you're hitting on a few things that are common experiences for a lot of people of your generation. But I'm interested to find out what memories you have of those early years. You say growing up on a farm. Oh. I'm thinking you probably had some chores even at a very young age that most of us don't have.
Oh, yes. One of the ones I hated worse was what they call stripping the cows by hand when they'd gone through and milked the cow, and then the cow has a little milk left in the udder, and you had to get the last milk out because we needed every penny that we could get. That was my job, with a little pail that syrup came in, a little metal pail, and that I'd strip the cows after my dad and older brothers would go through and do the milking, and I'd go behind and, like I said, call stripping the cows, getting about a quart of milk or more that would help make the payments that we had to make.
Yeah, and what a picture. I mean, what a microcosm of what a lot of people were going through during the Great Depression. That sounds like that was a very real feel of that for you.
It was. It really was. There was many things like that we didn't have toys or anything much to play with, so we made our own, and I'm sure a lot of you people would remember that too.
Can you give us an example of that? Was there a favorite toy that you put together yourself?
Sure was. You took a lath and made a T, and a long handle like this with a T, and a little metal wheel, and you'd push that all around the barn area and the house and so forth. That was one of the exciting things.
Do you remember at that age having a dream or an ambition, something, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
Not on the farm. I didn't, that I can recall. I did in the service.
And we'll talk about that. But since you mentioned losing the farm, you know, this is something that happened to so many American families in those years.
Yes.
How did that affect you and your family? Did you get a picture of how hard that was for your parents?
Oh, yes, because when my father, after selling everything on the farm was 260 acres, selling everything, he had $1,200, and he had made up his mind that he couldn't make a living farming because everybody was losing their farms. Most of them, rather. He went to work in a grocery store in Rochester, which was 25 miles from Chatfield. He worked there for about 6 months when he was told by the manager, and again, at that time, sugar, flour, and that type of commodities were in, flour was in 25 and 50 pound bags, sugar came in 100 pound burlap bags with a type of a canvas bag inside the burlap bag. And he was told one day, the manager told him to go and poke a pencil. Into the bag and drain out 10 pounds. The manager told him, he says, no one will know that there's any sugar out of that. He says, we can sell that as 100 pounds and use the 10 pound on the shelf for profit. My dad said he wouldn't do it. He says, I'll quit before I do that. And he says, well, then you quit. He came home, and of course, no income. Like I said, he left the farm with these $1,200 and went to Spring Valley, and he rented a building. The rent was $50, and he paid the $50. And then he went to the other stores and talked to the owners and managers to see how they handled things. And they told him that he was crazy, that he should never have rented that building. He says, you'll never do it, and you don't know anything about the grocery business. And so he went and put that back and never took the building, let the money go, and went home and told my mother, and she talked him into going back and going through with it. She says, we'll do it some way. He went back and rented a little building and started. That was the first in starting the grocery business. We worked it as a family with no help. He didn't know how to buy groceries or anything. He went to a wholesale house, which was in a nearby town. He told the fellow, he says, I need groceries to fill the store. And he says, I don't know how to put them, arrange them on the shelf. And he says, I don't know what I need, but he says, I'd like to buy my groceries order from you. And he said, if you would come and help me stock the store and help me arrange it on the shelves, he says, I'll buy groceries from you for as long as I'm in the grocery business. And his name was Leo Steer. And he said, yes, he says, I'll take care of it. And he says, you don't have to pay for it now. You can pay for it as you sell the merchandise. And he says, I'll come down and put it in. And that was our start in the grocery store. We worked as a family, all of us.
What was the store called?
You'll laugh. Jack Spratt.
Jack Spratt?
Jack Spratt.
Well, and I could tell because I could see your face, but I think everybody listening could tell too that when you told the story of his integrity, of refusing to poke the pencil in the bag and drain out 10 pounds of sugar, that choice that he made is something that made a very strong impression on you.
Oh, it sure did. And we were successful. I could go on and on.
You know, usually I would save questions like this to the end, but it seems kind of relevant here. I get the sense that those years for you, living through the Depression, watching how your parents handled it, being a part of an all-in family endeavor like this grocery store, I have a feeling that that kind of shaped your perspective on life a little bit. What do you think it taught you?
It taught me to be honest and respect that alone and how to work. How to do more than what you're asked to do. And I'm sure that helped me in the service to get where I got.
Well, you also lived through something that most of us listening right now didn't live through, but it's been my experience that anyone who did live through it has a memory of it. December 7th, 1941. I guess you were only 14 years old.
Right.
What do you remember about that day and how you found out?
I can remember sitting on the floor by the fireplace, listening to the radio and hearing what was being broadcast. It was hard to believe.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
No.
When did it start to become real? What were some of the things that followed that made you realize what was going on?
When they inducted my older brother, January 42.
So a month later, your older brother, who couldn't play sports in high school because of his physical condition,
right,
is getting drafted into the Army.
No, he didn't go to high school.
He finished in eighth grade, you said. Yeah. So that got your attention.
Absolutely. And when they marched through town, because they were inducting people almost weekly. They'd be a group that would go through town, get on a bus, and then go to Fort Snelling. That's where you were inducted, and that was very common. Everybody would line the street and wish them well, of course, I guess.
Was that hard for you?
Well, yeah, when it's your brother, it's one of them.
When your brother and all these other draftees are marching through town, is there any concern in your mind that he might not come home?
Probably not at my age at that time, not realizing really what a war was going to be like and what it is until probably, I'm going to say, even a year later. Then it starts hitting when they start talking about in our house.
When you start getting letters from Harry and hearing some of the places he's going?
Yeah, I wonder what you're going to do. You start thinking, and in school, especially on the football team, because that's where a lot of us conversed a lot about different things, because we were all about the same age and we were getting close to being drafted. We'd already, by that time, it was in high school, of course, and we'd already had our draft cards. We were already classified as 1A. The war was in full force. all of us, especially on the football team, were talking about, well, what are you going to do when you graduate? What branch are you going to go in? And so forth. And of course, I was listening in on it. And I was one of the younger ones, I admit. And, well, they didn't want the Army, and didn't want the Marines. I said, what's left? Well, he said, just the Coast Guard and the Navy. And so happened to be five of us, kind of the tough players, bragging a little bit. And we decided that we were going to join the Navy. And this was in 44. The five of us said that we were going to go up and enlist. So that's what we did in December. We went up and enlisted. And at that time, as you may recall, the war in Europe was looking great, and they were closing in on Berlin. We were hoping that we could get into the Navy. My brother, middle brother, he didn't. He had to go to the Coast Guard. They weren't taking anybody in the Navy at his. That was 2 years before this.
Right.
So he didn't want the Marines or Army, so he picked the Coast Guard, and they did take him. And anyway, the five of us, they went through our physicals and all that and passed everything and ready to be sworn in. And then an officer walked in, and he said, we're going to send all these home so they have Christmas at home. He says, we'll take them after Christmas. And so that's what happened, and we were inducted into the Navy. And we were supposed to have 14 weeks training, and they cut it to 7 because they were getting closer to Berlin all the time, and things were looking up that we had to get to the Japanese in the Pacific, so they were pushing us in the Navy. And I, to this date, I swear that in our company of 128, that there wasn't one person other than the sergeant in charge that was over 25. Mm-hmm. We were all young. We were young and stupid. And we never even got a chance to get to what they call small stores. That's like a place where you could buy candy bars and ice cream and stuff. We never even got out of our barracks. We were always penalized for something. But we did. We pulled 7 weeks.
Where was that?
In Great Lakes.
Great Lakes, yeah. And before that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, since you were only 17,
right,
you had to get your parents to sign for you too, right?
Absolutely. And the only reason that my parents would sign, as you remember, the Sullivan brothers, all five were gone on the one ship.
On the Juno.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I had a brother in Germany at the time, my older brother. And Warren, my next brother, the Coast Guard one, he was scheduled to leave to go overseas. So my mother wouldn't sign for me. My dad did, because he knew he wanted to go to the service. And he knew that he could have my feelings. And so he signed, but mother wouldn't. And then we told her about the Sullivan brothers that were gone, and she remembered all of that, of course. But we said, now, if two are overseas, the third one doesn't have to go. So I said, and my dad, I can hear him yet, too. He says he won't have to leave the United States. And, of course, mother said, are you sure? And, yeah, we're sure. He says, since the Sullivan brothers, he won't have to leave. And so she reluctantly signed. So that's how I went in. And I was overseas in May.
And who knows what their conversation was at that point?
I sure don't know.
But since you mentioned your other brothers, I'm interested to know what they went through in the war as much as you know.
And oh.
I am noticing, too, that your oldest brother was Harry Bailey.
Harry Bailey, Jr.
We've all seen a movie where there's a World War II hero named Harry Bailey. It's a Wonderful Life. I wonder if he got those comments the rest of his life.
I don't know, but he drove supply trucks,
uh-huh,
is what his job was. And my middle brother was unloading, of all things, buttons in New York.
That was his Coast Guard job?
Yeah, and he was unloading buttons. And the buttons were 70-pound wooden boxes, and they were coming down a roller of the truck that he was unloading to put on a ship, I guess. And you know how fellows are. They was seeing how fast they could put the boxes on the roller going down, and he was catching them and stacking them. Well, he turned his back to stack, and one of those boxes hit him in the back and cracked two of the vertebrae.
Oh.
And that's what put him in the hospital. And then that's how come I had to go overseas. And my, like you said, I'm sure my mother was beside herself. She never showed it, though.
And I just want to understand the motivations. You mentioned being with your four football teammates. What do you think it was that said, this is the time we need to get in now? Where did the motivation come from?
Well, we were afraid we were going to be drafted. At the way things were going, they were taking as fast as they could get help. Military people, they wanted everybody they could get. Uh-huh. And that's why they were pushing through the trainings and stuff so fast.
Did you guys think you were going to be able to stay together, the five of you?
We thought that when we went in, but that was a whole lot of something else. That's quite a story. Everything was alphabetically in line, from A, B, C, on down the lines. We lined up after we come back. We had to leave from boot camp. We were given 5 days. It took us 1 day to get home, 3 days at home, and 1 day to get back again. So we were only home 3 days. Like I said, everything was a hurry up, and we get back and all get it together, and they lined us up and had us all in alphabetical order in a line. There was 128 of us, and the first 10, they come over and crossed us off and said, the first 10, step over here. Well, there went everybody but the one other ball player with me, Don Billman. He and I always got along real well. And he said, you 10, or you're going to Treasure Island. Of course, neither one of us even knew what Treasure Island was. And so they put us on a train, and it was a cattle train. It was nothing but an empty thing with the bunks on the wall that folded down during the day, except the bottom one. That made us a place to sit, and the other ones folded down. And that's the way we came across to Treasure Island.
It's time for our first break, but we'll ride along on Wayne Bailey's World War II Navy adventure when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.